We're going to address the subject of thoughts about time and end time.
Yeah.
And Kate's going to start it out. And if you feel like interrupting, and you think it's appropriate at that point to interrupt, you can. Except when Kate is in the middle of her readings on poetry, we'd rather not have you interrupt. And when I'm in my closing words to you, I don't want you to interrupt either.
Well,
you can get to me later.
Even if it reminds one of Nixon.
I'm not discussing Nixon today.
How do you decide when you're closing?
I'll tell you.
There's a certain tone of voice he takes.
Yes.
I know that tone.
See, she's only been here 4 days. Yeah. And she's figured it out.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
supper's at 5:30.
And you may get up and leave if we're not through.
Yes, you may. And you may interrupt me, too.
Pardon?
You'll be through by supper.
We plan to close out unless you have too much to say.
Oh.
We will be finished at 5:30.
Okay.
All right, Kate, you're to begin.
Well, Leo said that I could begin. And just before I came in, of course, I met him. One always meets the people you need to meet providentially. I said, what are you going to do? And he said, well, among other things, I will talk about redeeming time. I thought, well, that's very interesting, because I was going to start out with Eliot saying, time is unredeemable. And yet he does redeem it and comes into the stillness and arrests the current of time by careful patterns and careful forms and careful liturgies. Now, I'm reading from the Four Quartets, which is when Eliot was in the heyday of his Anglo-Catholicism and was very interested in getting into the stillness by very, very carefully thought out liturgy. So we're going to tackle the problem of redeeming time from two, I think, quite different angles. We're going to make, I think, a kind of quilt. I'm going to put in a piece, and then Leo will put in a very brightly colored piece. And then you may put in maybe a dark or a light piece, and then in an hour you can make the most wonderful quilt of discussion and thought, and you go out of here, and then all through supper, of course, you're talking about what we talked about instead of letting it drop exactly at 5:30, you see, because this idea of time is very exciting. Every one of you has gone through the experience, I think. You come to Holden, and within 2 days, the nature of time has changed. And you find yourself saying, well, when did I come? I think I came in on Monday. Was it Monday? Have you ever done that at Holden? This in a very low level, I think, is something about what we would like to say at a very high level. Now, this is what Eliot says. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction remaining in a perpetual possibility, only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory down the passage which we did not take towards the door we never opened into the rose garden. My words echo thus in your mind. But to what purpose disturbing the dust on a bowl of rose leaves? I do not know. Other echoes inhabit the garden. Shall we follow? Quick, said the bird. Find them, round the corner. Through the first gate into our first world. Shall we follow the deception of the thrush into our first world? There they were, dignified, invisible, moving without pressure over the dead leaves in the autumn heat, through the vibrant air, and the bird called in response to the unheard music hidden in the shrubbery, and the unseen eye beam crossed, for the roses had the look of flowers that are looked at. Words move, music moves, only in time, and that which is only living can only die. Words after speech reach into the silence. Only by the form, the pattern, can words or music reach the stillness. only by the form, the pattern. I think of the hodgepodges we make, instead of making beautiful patterns in our formal situations. Only by form can words or music reach the stillness, as a Chinese jar still moves perpetually in its stillness. Not the stillness of the violin while the note lasts, not that only, but the coexistence, or say that the end precedes the beginning, and the end and the beginning were always there before the beginning and after the end. So this really set me thinking. And I thought of the movement in the Eucharistic liturgy, which is, of course, a great drama. First of all, possibly, the movement of the celebrant as he uses his whole body to welcome the people, to absolve the people, to praise God, and brings the people present at the meal by his own movement into the liturgy, and as they are brought, somehow, I think, time is redeemed. I was thinking, particularly when we were doing the Day Spring this morning that I love so dearly, I was thinking, how do we, in the routine of our lives, somehow touch the Day Spring from on high? And it seems to me, here again there is a movement. I think particularly in the sacrament of penance, there's a movement towards the priest. And then after the absolution, there's a fantastic movement backward. And there's a real feeling of Day Spring as you really start a new life after auricular confession. This is a very thrilling way, I think, to make the days new, just as new as that snow out there, as you see it settling, and it's so white and it's so pure, and it's really the beginning of another landscape. So here you have just the beginning of the ideas I have constantly in my mind on the fantastic work of movement in our liturgies as we gather together for corporate worship. Of course, I'm not talking about private worship at all. I'm talking about what it is to have 150 people gathered there, many of them so vulnerable they will not advance beyond the back pews. Have you ever had that problem if you're an usher? And you can rope off the place, you can do anything. They're too vulnerable. They're going to stay back there. And you cannot get the movement forward until something in the liturgy makes them feel that they too are gathered around the table, just as we are gathered around this fire. And I think that this is what the celebrant does, and I think this is what vestments, the whole thing we're doing in the renewal of the spirit, the renewal of the liturgy, is possibly about. I think it's redeeming time.
Thank you. How we came to do this is I think rather interesting, because I had planned something for Friday or Saturday, and since I wasn't prepared for this, on Friday we did the report of the scientific committee and other things. But I was thinking about several subjects, and usually the subjects I discuss here are subjects that I need to perform some scholarship on. On the subject of time, has been great concern to me, and for ever since I've been in having administrative duties, I've always run out of time, and my life is run by this. By this little thing that I keep in my pocket, and that's my appointments for the day, or where I have to go next, and this runs my life. And my administrative assistants in my former location in here, they said, well, you don't have any time. I mean, they're trying to protect me from interruption, until I finally convinced them that my life as administrator was a life of, that was my business, was interruption. But it's always this pressure of time, and so this I've been collecting material on this, and in conversation with Kate just a couple of days ago, we got off on the subject of time, and I said, and she had some interesting things to say about it. So I says, that's what we'll do on Saturday. That's how we came about it, and I'm glad that we postponed it till today, because Lou Wager, for those of you who made breakfast today. Kate was sitting with me at breakfast, and she says, Just before I was to say it, she said, you know, there was the summary of our talk tonight. In words to that effect, and that's what it was. The utilization of time, a redeeming time. That's what the subject was this morning. So it's providential, yes. And then I often look at book reviews because I'm interested in books and because many of the people in the audiences here at Holden, one of the things we try to do is to get the people reading. And I often refer to books during my lecture. Sometimes I have to reach quite a ways to bring in a good book. I'm not sure about this book, but the subject was very interesting on the book reviews. And it's sort of the introduction to what I'm going to talk about, or maybe it's no introduction at all, but as we talk about the redeeming time and end time. But this subject was about killing time. And in fact, the title was Killing Time in France. And I thought that was appropriate to discuss with a French teacher. And it's really a review of a book on history entitled France, 1948 to 1945, Volume 1. It's by Theodore Zeldin. But why I brought it in was the introduction of the various types of time. And historians, you look at that and you say, well, that's typical of historians. They're very chronologic. They take everything lockstep chronologically, don't they? But this historian didn't. Only in the title is he chronologic. He instead of saying from 1945 to, you know, mixing it up, he at least has that orderly. But there's no structure in it. And he suggests that, they say that he has broken radically with this tradition of taking subjects into units, for he felt that clearer thinking about present ideals, habits, and institutions would result if the presentation were not chronologic. He thought it'd be better to integrate it, and that's what he did. So he discusses many subjects: marriage and morals, children, women, on other very interesting subjects. So you can check that out and tell me. I usually have my wife read, or my older daughter read the book first, and then they tell me whether I should read it or not. Also, musicians, as you brought out, I mean, time is very important to them. It used to be. The music I hear now, I'm not so sure if they respect time. Artists, if I interpret them properly, and I probably do not, they freeze time, don't they? They freeze time. And we have subjective time, psychological time. And time has often been expressed as a womb. Biologists deal in time, of course, and in milliseconds. Some actions are very rapid, so we discuss in just fractions of a second. The physicists outdo us, some of them in microseconds. And it is of great concern to them. And then there's God's time, end time, and redeeming time, some of which we'll discuss. And there's geologic time. And if Peter is here, he may wish to discuss something on geologic time. They deal in tremendous amounts of time, 4.5 billion years or something. So he may wish to say something about that. Do you want to say something about it right now, maybe? Not yet. Okay. Well, we're down one page. Time, the Apostle Paul says, is a fragment of eternity. Although God is beyond time, God has given us time as a solemn stewardship. We are directed to redeem time. Paul, in his discussion of time, used the language of the marketplace. We are to look at time the way a merchant assesses a commodity before he buys it. We are instructed to weigh and assess time because it is a sacred trust to us. The Spirit of God can declare, "Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation." There are also other indications that there is a right time, and it may be short. Paul recognized that of all the good and perfect gifts from God, time is one in which that he gives us, his creatures, very sparingly. We are allotted one moment at a time. And when used, whether for good or evil, it is gone forever. And with the passage of each minute, we are 1 minute closer to our death.
But may I interrupt?
Sure.
Unless those minutes have a certain rhythm, it seems to me, time becomes something that we want to waste, we want to kill. I'm sure you've heard people say, well, I'm just sitting here before the TV, I'm killing time. And it is because, possibly, in their barren lives, like grains of sand, moment succeeds moment succeeds moment, but there isn't any of the rhythm that gives a pulsation and a life. And so although I think this whole idea, which the famous French religious thinker de Caussade had, the sacrament of the minute, I think that's a very important idea. But we need to be very leery of it, because actually, unless you put that minute into a context of meaningful minutes, you could find yourself in a terrible desert. And this is why you need a sort of an alternation of recreation. It seems so obvious, a very concentrated work, how many people, not realizing the strength it takes to really concentrate for even 15 minutes, how many people go on beyond the point of satiation. Say you have an audience. I'm sure, again, you've all gone through the experience. For the first 15 minutes, you really were in there. You were pitching. You were concentrating. You were getting what the guy was saying. And then at the end of the 15 minutes, when he could have redeemed his time, and just like a Chinese vase, have brought it into a certain shape, I'm bothered if he didn't go on to another point and you gave up. Isn't this possible? Because he did not put the moments that he was using into this pattern. And this is the great work of preparation. I'm sure never do you speak before people. Never do you have... See, the people can't escape. Do you realize what's happened to you people? Unless you had a coughing fit or the baby screaming, you can't get out. We got you, you see. And you see, and we can prostitute this use of time unless we're very, very careful. And I see it being done all the time. I don't think we realize the great work of concentration that really wrings people out. And about 15 minutes is all that most people can do this. And then the rhythm must change. And then you go into another 15 minutes of something quite different, possibly. Then you come back to the first, and it's like a fantastic poem. I'm sure that both for Leo and for me and for maybe half of you, this is the great art of teaching. I'm not saying instructing, I'm talking about teaching. The great art, and it is having this rhythm that you see in painting, you see it in music. Go on, you go on now.
And interrupt. Yeah, a good friend of mine, a pastor, said that everything beyond 15 minutes is of the devil.
I wish it were as affirmative of that as that. Because the devil believes in hell, but that belongs in hell. But what the people enter into is a terrible kind of purgatory. I would rather be in hell, I suspect, I don't know, than be in purgatory. I just don't know. But there's a sameness there, do you see?
Boredom.
Yeah, not a warm, beautiful gray, but a flat gray. But I think boredom and satiation are the things I dread most in life. When you watch that glassy-eyed look come over a group of people, you know perfectly well, now is the time to redeem the time. But for this, you have to, usually I have one person, I picked out my dear PLU man right here, but he's behind me, so I can't do it. You usually pick out one person with whom you have a certain rapport, and they can signal you by their facial expressions. In school, of course, they start packing up their books. And if you're in a bad mood, you can't really say, is there a fire? I didn't hear the gong, or something stupid like that. But you have to be awfully careful to realize how marvelous is this time, and how marvelous are the people asking to be fed, and yet you didn't work hard enough to preserve a rhythm in what you were going to do. It is so hard to do what most of us do here, I'm sure, because we have teachers here and preachers and people who do all kinds of things, many of them one-to-one. And it requires so much work. That is why I know Leo will go and put himself in his office or study, he told me so the other day, and close the door. What's he doing? Very quietly, you're meditating, you're getting ready. And it's in the fullness of time, you emerge and tell them something.
Hopefully.
Time's up.
But you see, that's the importance of the dialogue here, and the importance of this cycling, that you participate, because this is then a change of pace, and it's it puts it on another track again. So somebody tells a joke, or you say something kind of stupid, which I'm very good at. And that's the importance then here in this winter community as well as the summer. And I don't know how it goes here in the winter community, but it's important that you have a dialogue, that you are challenged. And we had a pretty good dialogue going last night. This was once we got going. And this is important. It's important here now today. And in the carrying on the, this time, and what I was reminded of as I came to this point, I love streams. I love water. And I was born and raised on a small farm, and there was a stream, and then we moved, and then I would frequent another stream, and then my folks moved by a large river. And there was one thing I noted about the river. We'd go out there and we'd see things coming down the river, and we'd maybe go out in a boom, or when the creek was very small, not very wide, you'd watch something floating down, and then maybe you'd be in a position to reach it and grab it, or you'd miss it, and then it would go on and then disappear. And that's how time is. It goes like that. It just disappears. And the idea of time, or how we conceive time, varies a lot with what we're doing, but also reflects your age. And Alford has a poem about this that expresses it, my thoughts on it. When as a child I laughed and wept, time crept. When as a youth I dreamed and talked, time walked. When I became a full-grown man, time ran. And later, as I older grew, time flew. So on I shall find, soon I will find, while traveling on, time is gone. And that's sort of how we go through life. There are exceptions. We are instructed to redeem time, and by redeeming in this light, I am saying you use time efficiently. You recover time by expenditure of great effort. This is the definition of Webster that I would refer to in this. Time, if you look it up in a dictionary, has a lot of definitions, more than most words. Before we are even aware of it, we become involved in distractions, interests of everyday experience, and are thereby turned away from the great purpose of life. Paul says that we can acquire time by foregoing goofing off and self-indulgence. He didn't use goofing off, but I think that's what he meant. Even in the way, in the Living Bible, they don't use goofing off. In 1 Corinthians, he speaks of marriage, sorrow, joy, business, and pleasure as providing the possibility of either wasting time or acquiring time. When any form of association is directed only inward to pleasing one another, in the case of Chief and I, if I spend all my time trying to please the Chief, it would be futile, but I could try it, or she could, you know, waste her and spend her time just trying to please me. But this is, I think, a futile thing, instead of spending our time serving God. The time, if you just spend wasting, trying to please one another, that is wasted time. And what I say here for a couple also applies to this community, or to a church. Paul warns against the pessimism of sorrow in this instance. And I have counseled with people in great grief, and many of them, early in the stages of their grief, they will refuse to be comforted. I shall never get over this, there is no purpose in living anymore.
And I say that if you are still breathing, there's a purpose. Shakespeare wrote, I wasted time, now time does waste me. Our instructions regarding redeeming time does not extend to what we are to do, but how we are to employ time. Alford has suggested three uses of our time. To put it to use in guarded living is the first one, that we are to be a living reproof, really, to the evil in the world and be a witness to the really living reality of the Master. We are not to waste time being wishy-washy. Over 100 years ago, Robert Hall said of a friend, he was witty, but his sallies never caused a saint to sigh or a virgin to blush. We employ guarded living so that we do not have to regret wasted time and lost opportunity. Another use for time is by guided living, for God has a wonderful purpose and a plan for our lives. Unfortunately, too many of us don't fully realize this wonderful fact. So we wander rather aimlessly instead of seeking to understand what the will of God is. And at this point, I would like to recall for you, those of you who were here the other day, when we discussed Mary, what's her name was the title of it, and we remarked a great deal about Mary, and I closed it off by saying that we are to be ready and eagerly receptive and responsive to the coming of God's grace. And this was the mood of Mary in the quiet moment of the great announcement. How silently the gift of God is given. Mary, you see, belonged to that company of the pure in heart who lived each day one day at a time in dependence on the grace of God. And when the climactic moment came, she was ready. And her response is here for all of us to emulate. For her words will forever be the symbol of the humble and the obedient response to the grace of God. It was her true moment of glory when she said, Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to your word. This is the heart of all true religion. It is purity of trust in the living God and obedience to his will. For Mary, this was the meaning of life, to seek God's will and to do it. When Mary's faith leaped to meet the fantastic revelation to her of the will of God, she discovered it to be a spiritual adventure beyond her wildest dreams. And in our own situation, we too will find the same when we from the heart say, Behold your servant, Lord, be it unto me according to your word.
Could I say something at this point? To bring this up to our day, you will find in the shop a beautiful little book by Simone Weil, the French writer, now dead, called Waiting for God. And it's exactly this, as Mary waited. This French woman, who was Jewish, who could have become a Christian, but she felt in World War II, this was not the time to be baptized until more and more of her people could be with her, and so she just patiently waited for the will of God. And then very quietly, she died of TB caused by tremendous hardships during World War II. Sometimes I think, if I may say so, in our Puritan culture, we are frightened if we don't use every moment. But I have a strong feeling, in order to maintain this rhythm, which alone redeems time, I think we need to waste a lot of time. Most of us don't know how to waste time. In fact, somebody said to me today, and I think she was right, she said, play while you can, Kate. Now, I was brought up very strictly, and I find it very difficult to maintain this rhythm of wasting time. But just before I came in, may I read something? Because
sure.
I don't want, you know, it's really your show, dear love. They know you and they don't know me.
The
marvelous Northwest poet, Theodore Retke, that some of you know, wrote a poem about how we learn as we wait and take things very, very slowly. And sometimes doing things slowly means a certain amount of waste that we must not be frightened of. I let the students waste quite a bit of time. They don't know it always, but I'm well aware. And this is what he says in his beautiful poem, The Waking. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I feel my fate in what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go. We think by feeling. Here again, this whole business of liturgy, raising the consciousness. We think by feeling. What is there to know? I hear my being dance from ear to ear. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Of those so close beside me, which are you? God bless the ground. I shall walk softly there and learn by going where I have to go. Light takes the tree, but who can tell us how? The lowly worm climbs up a winding stair. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Great nature has another thing to do to you and me. So take the lively air and, lovely, learn by going where to go. This shaking keeps me steady. I should know. What falls away is always and is near. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go. Change the rhythms of the poem, I think, redeem the time in which it is spoken. I don't know how many of you are haunted by that little buzzer Leo was showing. 5 years ago, where I teach, all bells were silenced. I don't know whether in your time they had bells. All bells were silenced. Now you can imagine what happens. In many cases, the person just goes on and on. And the next person is waiting and cannot get in. Just as at the prison, we're so eager to put in a few last licks, because we won't be there again for another week, that the officers come around and call all out, head count at 9:20, and we won't let the men go. They don't really want to go. And it's a real problem, this sense of time without your buzzer. It's as if we needed a buzzer to keep us in order, you see, to keep us structured. And yet the real growth may take place in an unstructured situation. I'm ambivalent about it. Part of me says, I want to get in there with this guy, please stop whatever he's doing. Do you see? But the other part of me says, boy, there's an artist at work. He hasn't finished painting the picture. I don't need to get in there. So we need to think about the equilibrium, I suppose, between the buzzer and the non-buzzer.
You see, that's a handy part of this buzzer. You see, you can have your hand in your pocket, and if the thing, if things are not going well, you can just you can go like that, and then it's over. You see, or if it's going very well, you can turn it to last a little longer.
Notice the authoritarian Pope beside me. He's in control. Do you realize? Isn't that? Don't
sometimes.
You feel omnipotent?
In my position.
I know why that buzzer went off at my dinner one evening.
You know how to hurt a guy. But what you said, and what you said a little while ago, caused me to, I've been carrying around a couple of pages for quite a while, because when I was thinking about what to do up here, I was talking over in Skagit County some months ago, my Reformation, I guess. And someone gave me one of Nguyen's books.
I know, Creative Ministry.
Well, this was on solitude.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'll do something on solitude And it does have something to do here in the stillness of the thing. So I'm going to bare my soul for one page. On the basis of our Christian life is in the words of Nouwen, I should say, because he says it's now and then, pronounced like now and then. It's a careful balance between silence and words, withdrawal and involvement, separation and closeness, solitude and community, which sort of goes with what you've said. And then here's how I try to do it, and it may not be the thing for you. I know it isn't for a couple in my family. It just wouldn't work this way, that in the morning, long before dawn, to get up now and go off to a lonely place. Now, it is my habit to arise very early when few creatures are stirring, and not even the mice, to pray and read scripture and to meditate. Now, this is vital to me for the effective conduct of my life. I learned the necessity of this from the master teacher who sought a lonely place. He went there to find courage to follow God's will, not his own, to speak God's word, not his own, and to do God's work, not his own. Jesus' ministry was born and nourished in the intimacy with his Father in a lonely place. This lonely place in my life is a requisite for my survival. For without the quiet stillness of a lonely place, my sanity is threatened and my life is really in danger because I have so little uninterrupted time in which I can say there's no privacy. For without silence, now without silence, words have no meaning. And without words, voices no longer heal. And without separation, closeness cannot cure.
Can you read that again?
Without silence, words have no meaning. Without words, voices no longer heal. And without separation, closeness cannot cure. So without quiet stillness, without a lonely place, our actions, or my actions at least, for me become meaningless. So that's one page of burying my soul.
Could this be why the lives of so many of us have become meaningless? Because we flick on the radio, or we put on the stereo, and maybe for 8 hours at a time there's hard rock going. Many of us live in apartment buildings. And there is no escape. There is no escape. And so our lives become meaningless and alienated in the absence of silence. I've noticed this particularly, I think, in the last 10 years, to the point now that if I have 10 minutes of silence, I just bless those 10 minutes. And what are we doing to ourselves, corroding ourselves by the constant flicking on of the media? Constantly, where I live, before the people take off their hats and coats, they press the button of sound. It's incredible. There is no silence, you see. And then with all the things that, with which you amplify now, even to putting it on the floor above my head, the constant beat, 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 until all meaning has gone. And I'm wondering if the whole business of the drugs and alcohol, all the stuff that we hear about all the time, part of it might be because we have no silence. I feel this very strong.
Someone want to respond at this stage? Or?
It actually becomes frightening to have that silence. When it's not a blessing, it becomes a curse.
I'm very lonely. Many people I know are alone, and somehow this background of sound is a kind of pseudo-friend. Do you see? At least there's some pulsation going there, and they're frightened to be frozen blocks, I think. At least there's something there. They don't have a dog or a cat or something to huddle with, but at least the blessed sound, and I'm not talking about great classical music or something which has a certain rhythm, but which in itself must be followed by deep silence if the echoes are to fall upon you like a benediction.
All right, the third utilization of time, according to the fellow I was quoting, was to that our lives must also be governed, in addition to guarded and guided, governed by God, and this governance only extends to the life that is wholly given over to his indwelling spirit. Only when fully governed, and we had some discussion of the Holy Spirit last night, only when it's only when fully governed by the Spirit of God can we really redeem time effectively and utilize it efficiently. And it takes effort. To be filled with the Spirit is not only a blessing to be enjoyed, it is an order to be obeyed. The Spirit's filling is nothing short of God in control of our whole life, flowing everywhere into it so that he can flow freely out of it into a world of people in need. One time a group of ministers were discussing the possibility of a large evangelical outreach in their city. This was many years ago, at the time of Dwight L. Moody. And one of the people recalled for the audience that about Dwight Moody's success, and one of the pastors who was unimpressed with Dwight L. Moody asked this question: does Mr. Moody have a monopoly on the Holy Ghost? Another person said quietly, no, but the Holy Ghost seems to have a monopoly on Dwight L. Moody. At the cathedral in Milan, Italy, three significant inscriptions appear over the doorway. Over the right portal, below a sculptured wreath of flowers, there's a proverb inscribed that says, all that pleases is but for a moment. And over the left portal are a cross and a crown, under which are these words, all that troubles is but for a moment. And over the central door are these simple words, nothing is important save that which is eternal. Now, we're going to call for some discussion or questions before we go into the end time discussion. Why don't you say something about geologic time, Peter?
Do
you want to?
Hard to know how to talk about geologic time phenomena in such a way that we can talk about redeeming that phenomena. Different language altogether.
I know it.
Geologic time is a relative way of measuring series of events. There's no clock by which you can measure plus or minus a million years if you're talking about a fossil. About the best you can say is this happened before such and such a time, or such and such an event, and this happened after that event. And our estimates aren't very precise. It's not in the way we think about it. Plus or minus a million years. That's a large variation.
Well, when you're talking in 4.5 billion, that isn't too far away.
As a phenomenon, it's even difficult to know why time goes in the direction that it goes in. best thing that we can say is that the direction time has taken is the result of some condition in the very beginning of creation. That's close to it, as we come to the terms of a phenomenon, an observable process.
Why I wanted you to bring that out is that because it serves sort of a bit to introduce God's time and sort of how does he operate, and Alice and I had a discussion of this, and she goes, Alice goes first to the Bible, but then she also goes to Luther and to C.S. Lewis. And when we were talking about this, she says, well, you remember in Mere Christianity, there is a discussion of time, and I had forgotten it. But she says, I don't understand all of it. And I'm going to read you just a few words about God's time, from Time and Beyond Time in Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. Almost certainly, God is not in time. And God is not hurried along the time stream of this universe any more than an author is hurried along the imaginary time of his own novel. And he goes on and he describes that he's trying to make an analogy for how God is not in time. And he uses the analogy of an author who is saying, in this case, he's writing this novel, and he writes, Mary laid down her work. Next moment came a knock at the door. And Mary then is in time. But the author is not in time. He can then stop and think about this for 3 hours, about Mary. This isn't a fully good analogy, but he says that at least that it might be helpful. He says, the way in which my illustration breaks down is this, in that the author goes out of one time series, that of the novel, only to be going into another time series, which God does not do. To go on a bit, I would like to read, God has no history. He is too completely and utterly real to have one. For, of course, to have a history means losing part of your reality because it had already slipped away into the past, and not yet having another part because it is still in the future. In fact, having nothing but the very little tiny present, which is gone before you can speak about it. God forbid we should think of God that God was like this. Even we may hope not to be always rationed in that way. And where Alice had a question, one of the question marks she had in this was sort of God on a piece of, God is sort of the piece of paper on which you draw the line chronologically of your life. And what I would like to look at is sort of, maybe we can use this dome on this fireplace, and my life is just a very small part of this. Maybe this is all geologic time, and a very small part of this. I can put a mark here, and that's birth, and I move a little further, and the only time I have any concept of it is for the moment, and for just a few years back that I can recall, and I don't know the future. But to God looking down on this, he sees all of it at one time, what is both ahead and behind. And this is how I describe this piece of paper, and then with these words. Another difficulty we get into, if we believe God to be in time, is this. Everyone who believes in God at all believes that he knows what you and I are going to do tomorrow. But if he knows what I'm going to do, that I'm going to do so and so, but how can I feel free to do otherwise? Well, they're here once again. Difficulty comes from thinking that God is progressing along the timeline like us, that is, around that periphery. The only difference being that he can see ahead and we cannot. Well, if that were true, if God foresaw our acts, it would be very hard to understand how we could be free not to do them. But suppose God is outside and above the timeline in that case. What we call tomorrow is visible to him in just the same way as what we call today. All the days are now for him. He does not remember you doing things yesterday. He simply sees you doing them because though you have lost yesterday, he has not. He does not foresee you doing things tomorrow. He simply sees you doing them, because though tomorrow is not yet there for you, it is for him. You never suppose that your action at this moment were any less free, because God knows what you are doing. Well, he knows your tomorrow actions is just the same, and it's just the same way, because he is already in tomorrow and can simply watch you. In a sense, he does not know your action till you have done it. But then the moment at which you have done it is already now for him. So he's looking down on this timeline, which is all of history, starting with Peter way back there 4.5 billion years ago and coming around. And he's seeing this at one time, including that which is still before us. And that's...
Isn't this because there is no linear time in the world on the other side, it seems to me.
It's not a linear thing.
And yet most of us think constantly in our interior conversations with ourselves. We're constantly thinking in terms of linear time, aren't we? But we need to think, I'm pretty certain, in terms of either a cycle of time, or really backing up what you say, that amazing beginning. In the beginning was the Word. See, going back, again using us, because we know our lineage, so in the beginning satisfied us in some way. Talking in our terms, and the Word was with God, and the Word was of God. Strange words, really, which really have a lot to do with the concept of time and the Holy Spirit. I expect that the Spirit is always there, breathing on the chaos of our lives. But unless we have a lot of isolation, I think this is what Conrad saw. Many of you know The Heart of Darkness and The Secret Sharer. And if you look at these two things very carefully, Conrad always makes the moment of illumination a moment of isolation. In The Secret Sharer, the young captain is totally alone. He's taken over the watch, to the surprise, I might say, of those under him, on this boat. In The Heart of Darkness, the young idealistic man has to penetrate into the utter isolation of the heart of the jungle before he begins to understand diabolical things, and understanding those, understands, I think, at the same time, something of the meaning of the Word, because understanding comes through contrasts. Here's another thing. It has to be black against white. This is a thing I thought about a lot, the necessity of isolation for illumination. This is exactly what you do in the early morning, isn't it? But how many of us do this? Maybe most of you do. I don't know whether you do. It's almost impossible to do it without exhausting yourself, unless you go to bed fairly early. But if you're up until midnight or one, it's almost impossible to do anything but grab the coffee and get on the treadmill, because we're like hamsters. We're constantly in these cages. And so the time comes when you have to say, now I lay me down to sleep. He giveth his beloved sleep and trust. And even as early as 8 or 9, which sounds absolutely nutty, to seek this fantastic silence of sleep. About that, quite a bit, and I'm sure you have. Have a look at Conrad again, if you haven't looked at him lately. Here.
One of the remarkable things about this community is that there has been ruled out of this community one of those systematic interruptions. When you are here, you are quite sure the phone will not ring.
Yes.
Now, this is for us a great deal of the charm of Holden Village. We know that when we are at home here, the phone will not ring. And one reason we like it so much is that we are accustomed to it. We have structured our lives this way at home, because we built our own house, and we built it so that the phone will not ring if we don't want it to. And if Millie wishes an hour of quiet at home, she simply turns off the telephone. And this creates a kind of a dimension of freedom which is available, which is just not everybody's experience. I am surprised at how few people have done this to their lives, and have how common it is in human experience that we accept that that if I have an hour to myself, it is altogether possible that some idiot will ring my bell in the middle of that. And he's got the wrong number, perhaps, or he doesn't really want anything, but I always have that possibility that in the middle of my hour, somebody will ring my bell.
See, I have the opposite feeling that the telephone Christ can use it and save this time and space, but you don't have to run and be with everybody. That it might be Christ calling, so I never turn it off.
And it never occurred to me that he couldn't ring my bell anyway.
But you can't maybe ring the bell to bring a true connection. You can't to communicate, and it doesn't bother me. I might have the hour.
I'm glad your telephone is back.
Yes, but he goes into the wilderness time and time again to be alone, although he knows that the multitudes are seeking him.
He didn't have a telephone.
But he could have stayed there with the multitudes, yes. But he doesn't, because he knows that he has to be fed by silence. You see that? And he says, unless you be as cunning as foxes, this is one of my favorite quotations, you'll never be able to do my work. You've got to be leery of what I call people who are leeches, who will suck the blood out of you if you're not careful. And then anemic, you will try to feed them, but you have nothing to give them. And we must be careful about this. We really must. I think all of you know from your own experience how dangerous it is to have people suck your blood. And they will, because they are hungry, they're starving, they're alienated, nobody listens to them. What I love about Holden is the boat is not coming until tomorrow. Now this is so wonderful, you see, to know that the tide of in and out will not be today. Isn't it lovely that the boat is not coming?
Dave and
a couple of years ago, the Reader's Digest ran an article authored by James Michener, and they titled it On Wasting Time. Maybe you remember that. I think he directed it primarily to young people, and he may have exaggerated it a little bit to make his point, but his point was that there wasn't anything you could do before the age of 40 that was really a waste of time. And I've heard the kids up here at Holden quite frequently say, I went to the wrong college, or I took the wrong course in school, and I wasted those years. And I don't think that's quite right. I think by the fact that they stated it, they gained some perspective on what they might do in the future, or what they are doing here is perhaps a drawing apart where they can consider where they're going, and again, granting a little license for exaggeration, I think the point was fairly well made that sometimes we as Christians feel that God's purpose is intended from the cradle, and that unless we are actively pursuing that, that we are somehow violating God. That may be true if we had all knowledge, but since we don't, we somehow have to gain the perspective to then determine the course we should follow.
Yeah. This is, I've had, frankly, same feeling of the pressure on me to utilize my time very efficiently, because I felt that I lost a lot of it in the war. Mm-hmm. I think, and this pressure has always been on me until fairly recently, when I suddenly realized that was part of my education too. Mm-hmm. And although some of it was fearful, it was probably necessary.
Well, who wrote that book, Where Did You Go Out When You Could Do Nothing?
I don't know. Anybody know?
Would that be by the same author as Please Don't Eat the Daisy? But I can't remember her name.
You, and then I'm going to close.
Well, I was going to say here, in the time allotted to us before the supper time here, didn't want to get into your epilogue at all, so go ahead. I yield to you, sir.
Thank you. I hope it's worth it. This is the end time now, and I'll go very fast because it's 8 minutes, but if the bell rings, the chow will probably wait 3 minutes. And this is the feeling at the end of the year. And as the end of any year comes, your thoughts are probably something like mine, and you look at it sort of with mixed emotion, because there's sadness that another year is gone. There's sometimes regret that it could have been different if you had done something differently. There is hope that next year may be better. And in every case, we realize that we are slaves to time, in a terrible bondage to it, and it never stops moving. Now, it's interesting to me that at the last Sunday of the church year, which is some weeks ago, that there's two very interesting lessons. Well, there's a lesson in the epistle, are very interesting. 2 Peter 3:8 to 14 is the epistle. And it's the one for that time of the church year. And you, of course, are moved to ask, as it happens here, with this scripture, how will it all end? We are told that he who came to us as a child in the cradle will come to us again. Peter tells us how. It's big, it's vivid, and it's cosmic. The heavens will pass away with a loud noise, the elements will be dissolved with fire, and the earth and the works that are upon it will be burned up, and the heavens will be kindled and dissolved, the elements will melt with fire, and that's the judgment. And this was very scary to me when I was young. And of course I thought it also preposterous, for I couldn't imagine that steel and concrete could be dissolved by fire, because they were permanent. Until I visualized, well, I didn't visualize, I saw it with my own eyes, as what we call, you'd call it an atomic bomb, which is in the business I was in, it was called a nuclear device. And when this was detonated, I saw with my own eyes how steel and concrete became just a puff of smoke. And that was the end of materialism. And I also recall my associates after their return from the South Pacific, when they had detonated a fusion device, an H-bomb, how they were very concerned, because it was not like an atomic device that was pretty quick. The so-called sun kept going bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And they began wondering, you know, is it going to keep going? They actually wondered about that. And I'm reminded of this at this stage. I think it was H.G. Wells who said, and someday a man will learn the secret of the atom, and then old Father Time will come with his keys and say, closing time, gents. But there is also hope in these words, for there are words about a new heaven and a new earth. It is most remarkably presented in the Old Testament lesson, also of the end of time, and it's one of my favorite Psalms, and you can read it later tonight, but it's about even the wilderness and the desert will rejoice in those days. The desert will blossom with flowers. Yes, there will be an abundance of flowers and singing and joy. The desert will become as green as the Lebanon mountains, as lovely as Mount Carmel's pastures and Sharon's meadows, for the Lord will display his glory there, the excellency of our God. And with this news brings cheer to all discouraged ones, encourage those who are afraid. Tell them, be strong, fear not, for your God is coming to destroy your enemies. He is coming to save you. And when he comes, he will open the eyes of the blind and stop the ears of the deaf. The lame man will leap like a deer, and those who could not speak will shout and sing. And it's very beautiful in any translation of the Bible. These passages, along with some others, give us a picture of the time when God is actually Lord. And what do you make of all that? These words are addressed to a common everyday problem. Say to those with a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. From the youngsters, fear of acceptance and getting the right kind of grades, to old people with the fear of death. There are all the variations and stages in between. That's where most of us are, much of the time, anxious about collisions of our cars and about sickness, teenage children, drugs, jobs, inability to find them, getting old, terror bombing, wanton killings. One isn't safe anywhere any longer. And one that disturbed me the other day was really distressed me. Somebody had robbed this gas station. They had tied up the two attendants, and then many people drove up And they filled their tanks with gas. Some of them even went in and kind of laughed at them and took their cigarettes and walked out, and they stayed there, 2 hours without being untied. It was terrible. There's good reason for all of us to have a fearful heart. It's perfectly natural and understandable. For here we are, quite defenseless, with no ultimate control over life or death, or what will happen in the future to us, despite all of our insurance policies, pension plans, savings accounts, and stocks and bonds. So we become anxious, and sometimes this anxiety focuses on us on special threats, and we become fearful, which isn't all bad, because fear of a wreck makes us drive more carefully, or fear of disease drives us to do the research to address the problem, or fear that the world may kind of become unglued maybe keeps us from a nuclear holocaust. Rollo May said there was, and that's another good name to remember for reading, he says there are worse things than fear. For example, with your mother, the hope for tuberculosis patient, as long as that person has a fever, there's still hope. When the fever goes, and there's no fever response, then it's gone. So we must use fear and anxiety constructively. Now, it is interesting to realize that these passages in Isaiah were addressed to a people who certainly had a fearful heart. They were people caught up between a rock and a hard place. Earlier, they had been carried off into exile. They were powerless to do anything about their situation, a situation which offered no hope, no future. Their plight seems familiar to our plight in many ways, the unemployed, the pensioners, and facing inflation. Anxiety feeds on this... on this powerlessness, and we see, although we sometimes make jokes of it. I remember when Ed Sullivan's show was canceled on television in New Yorker, which is kind of contemporary for any time. These old couple were before the TV, and they said, "What's so funny about Ed Sullivan getting canceled? We're pretty close to getting canceled ourselves." but we can laugh about that, but it's really not funny, because it has deep religious significance. When I was young, religion was explained away as something many people resorted to out of fear. This theory is not entirely dead today, because it's simple and it saves people having to take the trouble to think. The reverse now seems to be true, however. Dave Roberts wrote, "Our age, having dispensed almost entirely with fear of God, now finds itself paralyzed with dread when it contemplates man and his powers. And what makes this dread so acute is precisely the lack of faith, the sense that modern civilization has gone empty to the core." And that's really where we are. So when we return to this strange land and the images of Isaiah, where God is Lord indeed, we see, first of all, there is an end. We see boundaries and limits, and we do have boundaries and limits. Even though we're a generation of ticket fixers and escape artists, and when we have a philosophy shared with Linus that there is no problem too big that you can't run away from, we have to wake up to the fact that there is no place to flee. Like the shepherds, we can have our day with angelic hosts, but we have to go back to those stinky sheep, stupid sheep, that have an IQ below detection. And we got to go back there and work. But we realize that God sets an end to the history, mine and yours, and it is his history. The vision of the desert blossoming like a rose is his will for us and the world. That doesn't mean he's Mr. Fix-It, who's going to take care of everything while we're asleep and not disturb us. His call to us is for an obedient faith. His problems are our problems. He expects us to work them out with him. The security of our world and us are on his terms and not ours. That doesn't mean we won't be anxious, but our anxieties are centered on ourselves and our peace of mind. God doesn't have really very much to offer us. He that would save his life will lose it, he says. In a sense, God wants us to share his anxieties for us and for the world, and to be frank, there's probably no better way. Jesus had anxieties, so he understands them, but his anxieties were caught up in the concern for others, and this is the critical point. He wept over Jerusalem, he prayed for his disciples, and he sweat great drops of blood. There are many people who dig this in this frightening, anxiety-producing world, and they handle it by giving themselves to the needs of others. In other words, anxiety today need not end simply in complaining, and viewing with alarm the contemporary scene, wringing our hands or staring at the boob tube hour after hour for escape, developing bigger and bigger waffle butts and smaller minds. And that's what happened. No, you redeem your time by ministering to others. The answer, you see, to anxiety and fear and dread is not courage, but love. Perfect love casts out fear. It's the love of God translated into the love for our neighbor in need. It's just like Katie said the other day about Sister Teresa, that Jesus was there in these unfortunate, in dreadful disguise. We do this because the whole wide world is in his hands, and that's what the strange thoughts about the end of history says to us. The terrifying problems before us that cause anxiety, fear, and terror do not have the last word. God, who is all in all, has the last word. So say to them of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not, then help them, comfort ye my people. And so in that way, you redeem time. And I'm sorry, you're 3 minutes late for supper. Amen.